Okay. Remembering Sophia.
It's all okay.
It's all okay. But it's not all good. Remembering Sophia. Seminar Session 3, Act 2. Dr. David Miller started his seminars with us last fall by emphasizing that Jung was Jung in the singular and that Jungians are Jungians in the plural. Dr. Sonu Shamdasani has said very much the same. One can only speak of Jungian psychologies in the plural. The sole individual who could claim an authentically Jungian psychology has been dead for 52.5 years. And Dr. Jung spoke to this issue in his Tavistock lectures, which were delivered in 1935 in London. He affirmed there that there are necessarily many different psychologies, each appropriate for some people. He then added, and I quote, "I consider my contribution to psychology to be my subjective confession. It is my personal psychology and my prejudice that I see psychological facts as I do. Nobody is absolutely right in psychological matters. Never forget that in psychology, the means by which you judge and observe the psyche is the psyche itself. From my point of view, the best thing is to say that obviously there are thousands of people who have a Freudian psychology and thousands who have an Adlerian psychology. There is a total chaos in psychology. So do not be so frightfully serious about psychological theories. Psychology is not a religious creed, but a point of view. And when we are human about it, we may be able to understand each other."
He sounds like Pope Francis.
Now, currently, many people find Hillman's polytheistic archetypal psychology useful. It suits them. A few others are in tune with the radical monotheistic interiority of Giegrich's sublated psychology. And many, many others consider all of the above psychological babble to be complete balderdash. It makes no sense to them, and I appreciate that fact. So it goes. As Jung said, there is a total chaos in psychology. So do not be so frightfully serious about psychological theories. And this is true of my own presentation here. Sophia's myth, or Gnostic mythology, understood as a form of psychology, will resonate with some people and not with others. So it goes. Last night I talked about the nature of Gnostic mythology as a conscious and reflected mythology. The subtle peculiarity of Gnostic mythology is its self-consciousness of being mythology. So what is a conscious and reflected mythology? Psychology and Gnostic tradition affirms image and myth as realities met by human consciousness. It happens. It recognized imaginal experience as a fact, and it consciously reflects upon the images and myths produced by psyche. This tradition focuses on personal, subjective, experiential relationship with image and story and myth. The image or the myth is not meant to be concretized externally as a dogma or theory, nor worshipped as an icon. Those things are lifeless. It lives. Sophia's myth is not intended, again, as a history or a theology or an allegory of theology or dogma. It is not logical metaphysics. It is consciousness reflected on a powerful and primal image, a story that presents itself for conscious reflection. It is a formation of the imagination, a constellation of imagination into text. The text of a story or a myth. It was not thought up consciously. At least so people would argue, some people, including me. It was not thought up and constructed from precepts. The event of the imaginal is taken up as real and independent, and then it is consciously reflected. Conscious reflection is given to a mythic image. This is a mythopoetic hermeneutics. Mythopoetic hermeneutics. A manner of interpretively thinking with image. A thinking through image. Does that sound like a type of psychology? It sounds to me a bit like what we call depth psychology, or any psychology which evaluates imaginal productions of dream, of image, of imagination, or any psychology that reflects itself back upon story, human stories. Jung asserted, quote, "For the Gnostics, and this is their real secret, the psyche existed as a source of knowledge." End quote. A source of knowledge. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of what? A source of knowledge. Perhaps knowledge of the soul story playing in the background of life, of us, knowledge of a relationship between our awareness and a psychic reality of which we were aware. Jung intuited that for the authors and the custodians of this myth, their knowledge, their gnosis, and that's what the word means, knowledge, just that, was an experiential awareness that they were living in the psychic flux of image. Just as we are living also in that flux. It surrounds us on the outside, and it teems abundantly within us. A conscious and reflected mythology is, in this sense, essentially psychological. It is an experiential confrontation with the mystery, well, the mystery within us. Call it consciousness, call it the depths, call it life, call it flesh. So, in my recension of the story here, Sophia's myth is presented in three acts. This tripartite structure of myth has provenance among Valentinian Christians in Rome during the second century, but I'm not going to go into all those details. This is my telling of that story, my abbreviation, my recension. I called the first act, which we spoke about last night, the prologue, the pleromatic prologue, the prologue perhaps in heaven. Occasionally, I, as I said, tried to imagine how this might be theatrically presented. What are the images? What are the stage directions? Where is the set and the setting? But the time, as I said, is no time. And the place for this prologue is no place. Everything is at a threshold, at a timeless moment before. A dim half-light reveals and conceals the scene. The narrator speaks from the distance, from below. How am I to speak with you about the immeasurable, incomprehensible? For we do not understand these ineffable matters. Ineffable. No image. And none of us know those immeasurable things. And on stage, absolute stillness, a quivering, an eye opens. He sees, she is present with him. End. Act 1, prologue. Mind meets image. Thought meets conception. Beginnings. Everything begins in this relationship. Intermezzo. From vague prefigurations, increasingly more defined images emanate, emerging one from other. It is as if on stage multiple gossamer veils are lifting. Two figures now become discernible, one masculine, one feminine. One is called Sophia, the other Logos, wisdom and word. A syzygy is revealed. There is no other action. There is no other plot. The archetypal image of it is simply and complexly two primal facts in relationship. Act 2. Sophia's leap. The second act moves more into archetypal images. It is a beginning of the plot, event, and a presage of time. Scene 1. Sophia is at stage left. She is the youngest aeon, a distinct but distant emanation of epinoia, the first conception of thought. Her nature is relational, and she is filled with a power of eros. Her desire, her seemingly unquenchable longing, is to unite with the source, the one who had seen her in the first dawn of awareness. But she is distant from that primal scene, off at the boundary of primordial being, at the threshold of time. She does not know where to seek him. All is vastness. There is only a dream memory of what it once was to be with him. Looking out beyond the edge of being, into the void, she sees a light. A glimmering upon infinite nothingness. She imagines it is he, the great source of light. Desiring him, seeking after reunion with him, she leaps into his embrace. But it is not he. It is no thing. It is just a reflection of his light. A reflection of his light in the vacant mirror of possibility. Desiring him, seeking after him, and imaging him to be the light seen mirrored from the formless void, she has jumped toward a mirage. Sophia has fallen into the depths. She has jumped into a projection. Scene 2. Now exiled in the void of the depths, Sophia experienced every psychic storm, and she was the nature of Psyche, every psychic storm imaginable. Her tears, her anguish, her sorrow, her loneliness, her exile, all these admixed with her light and condensed into the elements of cosmos. She became the first tissue of life. She has no partner, no syzygy. She is alone. Nonetheless, something stirred in her womb. Suddenly from her there separated a being of incredible power. He was a monstrous, abortive being. Full of splendorous, singular creativity. This fiery fact, sprung from Sophia, was filled with will and thought. Thoughts that became his unlimited creative powers. In classical Gnostic myth, he is called the Demiurge, the lesser force of creation. And he has several other names, among them Yaldabaoth, Sockless, the blind one. Jung called him Abraxas. Abraxas, A-B-R-A-X-A-S, an ancient name. Scene 3. The Demiurge, Yaldabaoth, Abraxas, Sockless, now marshaled a host of formative forces, agent archons of his power, and they molded a world. He then declared himself its master. He called himself the God of the world, the God above all gods, the one and only God. Next, he tried to form a man from the earth in his image to serve and worship him. But the result was a piteous, malformed clod of clay. Sophia witnessed the fiery domain being fashioned by this malefic and incomplete progeny. She looked at the lump of clay, and she was overwhelmed with compassion. And she breathed into it the spirit of life. She gave her life to earth. humankind arose and act 2. This is my recension, but this is true to the form of this myth in its textual traditions. Sophia is the mother of life, the breath of life, the spirit of life in this story. She is awakening, the awakening of the soul, dwelling within thonic, earthy darkness and time. She is the one who awakens humankind to the true source of life within them. She leads them to liberation from the fiery rule of the false lord of the world. Sophia, wisdom of God in mystery. Okay, is that a myth? Or is that psychology? Play with that image. And the first question is, who is this demiurge? Here Sophia is. She's jumped into the arms of a projection. Have any of you ever done that? Oh, that resonates. I know about that. And then you find out it was no thing. It wasn't the image that you thought it was. There it is. Act 2 begins with Sophia leaping toward a projection of the light, a mirror. And as a result, she's alone. She's in the depths. Despair, longing, exile. And then something comes forward from her. This is the beginning in the Gnostic mythology of cosmos. Very different in some ways from Orthodox stories.
So in that scene too, she's exiled and she becomes the first tissue of life. She has in her womb the demiurge, but there's still the hate. Remember, he saw her and she knows that he was nothing, even if everything before him. So there's still that he and she going on.
Where's he?
Where is he?
We'll get there. But the thing is, he ain't there. He's up in the sky.
Somewhere else, and then the demiurge is the one who
comes out of her.
Monotheism.
It comes out of her without relationship to him. But it comes out of her. This part of the story is always confusing to people. I mean, Sophia is this thing of light, but all of a sudden this abortive, malefic, nasty thing is coming from her. What's going in? Is that what she is? Or is that what comes when something is formed out of relationship to the totality? And that is actually the theme of the Gnostic myth. The problem was that this creation had taken place without appropriate relationship to the Logos, the true bride and groom relationship. So what is this demiurge psychologically? Any ideas? Is it just God? Or is it something psychological?
You say it marshals beings who mold the world and the one and only God. So it's what the force that leads to a monotheistic worldview.
It is a force working in our world. Or in us. Now, many of you have heard the name of Murray Stein and perhaps even June Singer, both Jungian analysts. In the 1990s, both of them published independently essays. Some of the very few essays which have looked at Gnostic psychology in terms of Jungian psychology, they suggested that if one looks at this image of Abraxas, which occurs in Jung's psychology, in his 7 sermons, that it refers, or might be referred, or might be analogized to the ego. I am the one and only God. There ain't nothing else but me. Me. Oh, these images I keep seeing above my head. Oh, no, they're not there. I'm going to make a world in my image. I might even make some gods in my image. Well, I'll just be their God, actually, in the end of it all, won't I? Ego? Creative thought. What do we see in our world around us? Exteriorized. Creative powers. Powers that make fire like that of the sun. Wow, that's a creative power. You can rule a world with powers like that. Or destroy it. And it's art, it's techne, technology, OGs. Every time I walk into an airport nowadays, I am struck by how different it is from just 15 years ago. And what is the difference? Every ear and every eye is glued techne. Art, it's sucking consciousness. Technology, it's sucking awareness. It's fascinating. It's glorious. It's fiery. It's a web. A web. That was another metaphor that the ancient Gnostics used for Sakhalas, actually. It was a great spider that wove a web and tried to catch the sparks of conscious light. And it fed on them, like Ungoliant in Tolkien's myth, or Shelob in the cave. Creativity, ego creativity, thought turned to the magic arts of creation in our world. Quite a power, not to be discounted. In fact, increasingly, it seems to be possessing us. I'll tell you another story. Something I noticed about 5 years ago. 5 years ago. And I've asked several other doctors now about this that I work with, and they've all noticed the same thing, although they had never conceived it in this way. You know, moms come into the ER and they're bringing kids, and the kids are fussy. And sometimes it's the one child or a sibling that has a problem, sometimes it's the mom that has a problem, and the kid is screaming his little, you know, brains out. And what did moms do 10 years ago? When the kid was doing that, they'd reach in their purse and they'd grab a keychain with the keys, and they'd give it to the child. You know, rattle, 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 rattle. Isn't that one of the oldest toys of humanity for kids? Wow, I can make noise. But then what would the kid do? Rattle, 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 rattle. Inevitably, the kid throws the keys on the ground. But what's the child doing? He's trying to enter into a game. What does the child want you to do? They're sitting there giggling. They want you to pick up the keys and give them back to the child, right? Okay, so you're sitting there talking to the mom, trying to figure out why she feels lousy. You give the keys back to the kid. What does the kid do? Rattle, rattle, rattle. Relation. Pick up the keys, give them back to the kid. The kid, immediately. And all of a sudden, you know, you're not having a conversation with mom anymore, so you just leave the kid in the corner screaming and try to work through it. The key trick didn't work. But about 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe it was longer, I saw a mother give her cell phone to the screaming child to look at. And when I saw her do that, I thought, this is a disaster. I mean, I'm sitting there, you know, you're trying to keep in touch with all the periphery of what's going on, because you've got to manage the whole, or you don't manage it, you've got to deal with the whole scene. And I thought, okay, this is the cell phone. And the kid didn't throw it. on the ground. The kids sat there like this. And I've watched this again and again, increasingly. And now, it's natural. Moms just hand the kid, or dads, the iPad, the smartphone, and all of a sudden the kid is there transfixed. The phone doesn't need that, you know, G-force protective case, because the phone stays in the hand. It doesn't go to the ground. But where is the child's relationship? The child is no longer interested in playing the game with me or mom. The child is in the grip of a relationship with technology. Oh, and what does this technology want from that child eventually? It ain't free. The web, the spider, needs to be fed. The technology is bait for the feeding, the spider. That makes sense.
We have a movie now about a love affair with a computer.
I really want to go see that movie.
Well, yeah. Stars.
Did you see it?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I think it's.
I heard him interviewed.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I read the reviews and I thought, and I actually even went and watched the preview of that one because this sounds like something that I've heard about.
It's her.
Huh?
Her.
Her. Her. Her. Right. Great title.
Scarlett Johansson is the voice.
Okay, Demiurge. Now, what does the Demiurge have to do with Jehovah? And what does it have to do with the Jungian self? And this is really the issue. With Hillman, this always bugged me. And I'll get into this in our next month. And David Miller, when he was here, told this story, and it's actually in the Dick Russell biography of Hillman. Hillman tells the story about the Jewish father. It's in one of his essays. He told it in lectures. It's in the book. And the dad's playing with the child. The child, you know, steps up on the first step of the stairs and jumps into his father's arm. The father catches him. The child giggles. The child goes to the second step, jumps into his father's arm. Child giggles. Father catches him. Child goes up to the third step, jumps into his father's arm, giggles. Child goes up to the fourth step, jumps. The dad steps back and he lands on his face. Hillman's story. What does that mean? Well, Hillman.
Not even your own father.
Well, Hillman said, "Don't trust a Jewish father." Jewish father. Hillman did not trust one big Jewish father. His name was Jehovah, Yahweh, monotheism, right? And he, Hillman, in his psychology, always related this Jehovah to Jung's self, that this was a precept of Jung's psychology, this worship of the self, which he identified as a monotheism. But what he didn't understand is Jehovah, in Jung's psychology, was the Demiurge. The Demiurge. There's a real distinction there. Hillman, I think, never quite got that experientially. He had his own complex with Jehovah, and it's quite understandable. A lot of people do. He did. Okay. So, Sophia and the Demiurge. And the Demiurge is trying to form life, conscious thinking, creation. Sophia is trying to breathe life. And indeed, God is not only trying, is succeeding in breathing life, soul life, into relationship with this thinking, creative human consciousness. Can you see those motifs? Can you see how that works through? Okay. A new myth was being born in that old age. And I suspect this myth is unlike myths you know of that age. I believe it is highly psychological. And so did C.G. Jung. older, and in that past time, then quite ancient gods, had lost vitality in that distant age. Human imagination was discovering a new human story. The power of myth forming then would echo in history, in human cultural experience, for 2 millennia, to this day. Orthodox Judaism, Kabbalah, Orthodox Christianity, and Gnosis all were rooted in myths, in facts of that time. Some of the people alive in that historical period consciously reflected on what was happening imaginatively in the formation. They heard the soul's story, and they wrote it down, and they considered it. They recognized a story of life within it, not conceptual life, not metaphysical dogma or logical life, but experienced life, Sophia's life. It was a myth, consciously reflected. The last act, Act 3, of the story, in my recension, touches human women, and through them, men. I remember I said that this story, if one were to use a Jungian paradigm, has an archetypal level, which is that first act. It's very, very diffuse. It's hard even to form any image of it. Then there's the second image, where the plot really begins. And now we come to the third act, which in Gnostic psychology would be called the Heletic level of interpretation. And that comes down really to facts of Earth, to stories of humans and their interaction with the archetypal realm. It's not entirely an ego realm. It's more of the sense of ego in association with the psychological, in that interaction with the psychological, with the soul fact. So Sophia is mixed up in flesh and earth and in fact of life. This final level of the story, images interact with humans. Women play a starring role. The myth enters a quasi-historical mode. Once again, it's never meant as concretized history. It is a quasi-historical mode where story and humans are together. Humans are players in this divine drama. And so what happens? This act of the story can be analogized with a Greek and then Latin myth appearing during the same general period, the myth of Eros and Psyche. It had some precedent, this myth of Eros and Psyche, in Greek imagery, but the tale as we know it was composed by Apuleius in the mid-second century, and it was composed in Latin. What's the plot? It's a long story, but pretty much all the imagery that comes to mind quickly is in the central act of that story. All is dark. A woman is in ecstatic embrace of a god. It is Eros. She longs to see him. See him. Fearing that he is a monster, she lights a candle while he sleeps to gaze upon his yet unseen sleeping image. A drop of her hot liquid wax falls upon him, and he awakes. He's aroused. He sees her. She sees him, and he is gone. Then what happens? She is cast into the world on a search for union or reunion with him. You've heard this story. Dr. Kimmel, in his seminar, spoke of it. Since its rediscovery in the Renaissance, it has received many interpretations. It struck at something alive in human imagination or psychology. And it was reimaged again and again. Is there psychology in that myth? Well, it's received psychological commentary, that's for sure. Do you see how it might relate to this act I just told of Sophia? Do women have a special relationship to this story of Eros and Psyche? I ask you that. You think so? No. No. Is there something in the story that echoes with feminine experience? Yeah? Would anyone like to elaborate?
She was cast to do those tasks by her future mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law, yeah. Oh.
Aphrodite wasn't happy. So no. She was the one that sent her down to do those tasks that were impossible.
But doesn't this kind of correlate with the story of the Holy Grail in that, you know, we touch something very special or specific, we lose it out of our innocence and stupidity or whatever you want to call it. And so we're always in search for it. So, I mean, it actually can be seen in both the masculine and the feminine.
In the semantics, there's no fixed meaning. That's the whole idea of the semantics. The meaning is really quite fluid, and it's multiple. Around the year 250, Plotinus wrote a commentary on the myth of Eros and Psyche. Dr. Patricia Cox Miller, who I mentioned last night, Dr. David Miller's wife, has compared Plotinus's commentary with a reading of the myth of Sophia in Gnostic mythology. The hermeneutics of myth, the interpretive use of myth, are similar in Plotinus and in Gnostic mythology. Both are given easily to psychological reflections. Multiple reflections. Reflection. Consciously reflected myth. Not conceptual interpretation. As Hillman said, that kills the snake. Dr. Miller comments on the traditional creation story, the orthodox story of the God who creates earth and shapes it like a potter, noting that there, in the orthodox myth, and I quote, the maker shapes a reality other than himself and is related to the object that he has forged from nothing by power rather than by nature. The maker shapes a reality other than himself and is related to the object that he has forged from nothing by power. Related by power, rather than by nature. But, by contrast, Dr. Patricia Miller continues, in the myth of Sophia, making is envisioned. Under the banner of desire, and I quote, under the banner of desire, it is a kind of desire that is set in motion when God is dead. That is, when God cannot be personified or finally characterized in understandable terms, but is rather called boundless. An unfathomable something that constantly eludes human categories and defies objective language that would distance the maker from what is made. The final act of the story of Sophia expands into the realm of human relationship and her relationship with consciousness. It also expands into a multiplicity of mythic accounts. There are many ways in which the story was told within Gnostic texts. In these many tellings of this tale, Sophia allies herself with human women, or even takes form in physical woman. The first such woman is, of course, the very first woman, Eve, the mother of all living. Consider, in the development of Christian theologics, at least in its victorious Orthodox forms, woman was a thing defiled. Nasty, watery, sinful, soulless, earthy Eve. Tertullian, who lived right at the end of the 2nd century, was one of the most important figures in the formation of this orthodoxy and a sworn enemy of the Gnostic hermeneutics of myth. And he wrote to the female members of the Christian community in the late 2nd century proclaiming, "You are the devil's gateway. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil did not dare attack. Do you not know that you are each an Eve? The sentence of God on your sex lives on in this age. The guilt necessarily lives on too." Tertullian, around the year 200. Those words echoed their effect upon Western culture and upon the psychological relationship and relationships of women. This, by the way, is a picture of Chagall. It's called The Cursing of Eve. But Gnostics did not read Genesis as history. It was a psychological myth. To them, Eve, as image of Sophia, was by nature superior to Adam, rather than his sinful inferior, as implied by Tertullian and centuries of subsequent Orthodox theology. Eve's Sophianic nature, her superiority and numinous power, manifests repeatedly in Gnostic myths. In these texts, she is Adam's awakener, the awakener. Adam is in a deep sleep, a lump of sleeping matter, from which Eve's liberating call arouses him. And in this, it is an image of Sophia. Eve calls forth to the sleeping Adam. And this is the story, again, from the very important The Secret Book of John, one of the central Gnostic texts. And I should add, it's also called the Apocryphon of John. Apocryphon just means a secret book. Four copies of the Apocryphon of John have come into modern hands. Four. These texts date to the 2nd century. Four copies of one extraordinary text surviving is almost unheard of. We have four copies of this text. Four recensions have come to us. All, I should add, in the last 120 years. So in the story, as told in the Secret Book of John, Eve calls forth to the sleeping Adam. And this is the text. "I entered into the midst of the dungeon, which is the prison of the body, and I spoke thus, 'He who hears, let him arise from deep sleep.'" Arise from deep sleep. "And then he," Adam, "wept and shed tears. After he wiped away his bitter tears, he spoke, asking, 'Who is it that calls my name? And whence has this hope come unto me while I am in the chains of this prison?' Who hears, let him arise from deep sleep. And Adam heard. And I spoke thus, and the I here is Eve, the Sophianic voice. And I spoke thus, I am the foreknowing of the pure light. I am the thought of the undefiled spirit. Arise and remember. Follow your route and beware of deep sleep. In another scripture from the Nag Hammadi collection, the collection of Gnostic texts that was found in Egypt in 1945, originally published in full translation in English in 1977, just republished 5 years ago in a new standard edition. In another scripture from the Nag Hammadi collection, which is entitled On the Origin of the World, the theme is further amplified. Here, Eve, whose mystical name is Zoe, and what does Zoe mean? Life. Zoe, life, is shown as the daughter and messenger of Sophia. Sophia sent Zoe, her daughter, who is called Eve. And now I quote from the text. I'm quoting from the text. Sophia sent Zoe, her daughter, who is called Eve, as an instructor, in order that she might raise up Adam, in whom there is no spiritual soul, so that those whom he could beget might also become vessels of light. When Eve saw her companion, who was so much like her, in his cast down condition, she pitied him, and she exclaimed, Adam, live, rise up upon the earth. Immediately her words produced a result, for when Adam rose up, right away he opened his eyes. And when he saw her, he said, you will be called Mother of the Living, because you are the one who gave me life. Eyes opening, arousal, awakening, relationship. And in this part of the story, who is the arouser? Sophia. See how the myth plays? From the archetypal level, down to a quasi-history. When Eve saw her companion, who was so much like her, in his cast-down condition, she pitied him, and she exclaimed, Adam, live. Rise up upon the earth. In another commentary on the Garden of Eden story, a favorite story for Gnostic psychological commentary, the Gnostic text, The Testimony of Truth, states that, quote, the serpent was wiser than all the animals that were in paradise. The serpent was wiser. Yet another treatise, The Reality of the Rulers, also known by its Greek name, The Hypostasis of the Archons, further informs us that not only was Eve the emissary of the divine Sophia, but Sophia mystically entered the serpent, who thereby acquired the title of instructor. The instructor then taught Adam and Eve about their true nature, informing them that they were not mere slaves of a creator deity. That creator deity was the demiurge, right? The singular function of creation. So, Dr. Patricia Miller adds in her commentary, Sophia and other feminine figures in the text are creatures of the middle realm, neither pure light nor pure darkness. They preside over the watery flow and pouring that mark the middle. The middle is erotic. Eros, as the ambiguous uniter of two realms, the fire and the blood, the dry and the humid, the male and the female, is a fitting embodiment of this middle. That there is a flow at the heart of things rather than a creator set over against the thing created, seems to be the guiding insight of the Gnostic myth in On the Origin of the World that we just read. The love of being with, the desire to connect, the dynamic which is the middle, provides the basis for all distinction. The essence of making, in other words, is loving. The question of origin is rather a question of the dynamic that empowers the coming to be of all things, the dynamic. This is my teacup, the Chagall picture of Adam and Eve in the garden. Notice the serpent is on center stage. Sophia, the serpent. Oh, and if any of you look at the Red Book of Jung, there's a serpent, repeatedly. Often has a crown, sort of like Chagall's glow. Wisdom. Sophia is also in that serpent. There is an ancient Gnostic symbol. There aren't too many of these things that survived. This is a symbol in text. Two words in a cross. What are the words? Phos. Phos. The omega in the middle. Phos. What does phos mean? Light. Like phosphorescence.
Photon.
Phos is light. Light. And Zoe. Life. Zoe, life. Zoology. Zoological. Zoo. Go to the zoo to see some life. Phos and Zoe. Light and life. And they cross in the omega, which is the end of all, or the symbol of all. They aren't apart. They are orthogonal, at right angles, and unified in a cross, the cross of light and life. That symbol has left me reflecting upon many things for the last 30 years. That strange image. So I want to close before lunch with one of the most extraordinary texts recovered at Nag Hammadi. It probably dates to the 2nd century, though it is impossible to say for sure. It was originally written in Greek. The version we have was translated from Greek to Coptic. It was discovered at Nag Hammadi. But who wrote it? That is unknown. Somebody put pen to parchment, or papyrus in this case. The text speaks in the voice of a woman. Who is she? Who wrote this? Scholars look at this text now and can find a legacy of her voice in many places at the beginning of our era. She could be Jewish. She could be Greek. She could be Egyptian. And of course, in Alexandria, all three of those cultures intertwined in the era of the composition of this text. But if she must be given or receive only one name, that name should be Sophia. This text has been identified with the Sophianic tradition. Listen to her. I'm only going to read parts of it. It's a long text. And hear a petition from the soul, the psyche, the anima, the immanent feminine voice of wisdom. She wants you, in this text, to recognize her, to meet her, to understand her. And this is a key text of what I call Gnostic psychology. The text is titled Thunder, almost like a Zen koan. Thunder, perfect mind. I was sent forth from the power, and I have come to those who reflect upon me. I have been found among those who seek after me. Look upon me, you who reflect upon me, and you hearers, hear me. And you who are waiting for me, take me to yourselves, and do not banish me from your sight. Do not be ignorant of me, for I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I am the members of my mother. I am the barren one, and many are my sons. I am she whose wedding is great, and I have not taken a husband. I am the midwife and she who does not bear. I am the solace of my labor pains. I am the bride and the bridegroom. And it is my husband who begot me. I am the mother of my father and the sister of my husband. I am the stillness that is incomprehensible, and the idea whose remembrance is frequent. I am the voice whose sound is manifold, and the word whose appearance is multiple. I am the utterance of my name. You who deny me, confess me. And you who confess me, deny me. And you who tell the truth about me, lie about me. And you who lie about me, tell the truth about me. For I am knowledge and ignorance. I am shame and boldness. I am shameless and I am ashamed. I am strength and I am fear. I am war and peace. Give heed to me. I am the one who is disgraced and the great one. Give heed to my poverty and to my wealth. Do not be arrogant to me when I am cast out upon the earth, and you will find me in what is to come. And do not look upon me on the dung heap, nor go and leave me cast out, and you will find me in the kingdoms. But I am compassionate, and I am cruel. Be on your guard. Do not hate my obedience, and do not love my self-control. In my weakness, do not forsake me, and do not be afraid of my power. I am senseless, and I am wise. I am godless, and I am the one whose God is great. I am the one whom you have reflected upon, and you have scorned me. I am unlearned, and they learn from me. I am the one that you have despised, and you reflect upon me. I am the one whom you have hidden from, and you appear to me. But whenever you hide yourselves, I myself will appear. For whenever you appear, I myself will hide from you. I am the substance and the one who has no substance. Those who are without association with me are ignorant of me, and those who are in my substance are the ones who know of me. I am the one below, and they come up to me. I am the judgment and the acquittal. I am sinless, and the root of sin drives from me. I am lust in outward appearance, and inner control exists within me. I am the hearing which is attainable to everyone, and the speech which cannot be grasped. I am a mute who does not speak, and great is my multitude of words. Hear me in gentleness, and learn of me in roughness. I am a mute who does not speak. I am she who cries out. I am cast upon the face of the earth. I prepare the bread and my mind within. I am the knowledge of my name. I am the one who cries out, and I listen. For what is inside of you is what is outside of you. And the one who fashions you on the outside is the one who shaped the inside of you. And what you see outside of you, you see inside of you. It is visible, and it is your garment. Hear me, you hearers, and learn of my words, you who know me. I am the hearing that is attainable to everyone. I am the speech that cannot be grasped. I am the name of sound and the sound of my name. And I would add, I am the syntax and the semantics. What a text. Who wrote that? 2,000 years. Is that a psychological vision? Is that a voice of something we encounter and call psyche? Thunder. Gnostic mythology. It's time for lunch. Thank you. I should add, I only read about a third of that text. I cut a lot of that. And when I went through this trying to cut the text, I couldn't figure out what to cut. Because everything I looked at just struck me again and again. So I was like, do I dare take that? But I knew I had to, because if you just keep reading it, it's just like, whew.
Oh, it's wonderful.
But that's only a third of it. It's more. There's more of the same. It's
available on...
Yeah, if you look for... Just look on my webpage. I've got all the... Every text I quote is on my webpage. If you do a Google search for any of these texts or name or Gnostic texts, you'll come right to my page. All this stuff is there. And if you look for Thunder, just look for Thunder, Perfect Mind. This was actually on the top 10 list last month of people looking for things. I had one day where I had 17,000 people look for this text in 1 hour.
Wow.
And I can't figure out what the hell happened. It crashed my web server. It was it did. I mean, it was like at 11:20 at night on the December 19th, my web server crashed from traffic for people looking for Thunder, Perfect Mind, this text.
Do you think it was contemporary? Is that right? Contemporary. Written contemporary? Or
that text? The Thunder text? The Thunder text, and it's also known as Thunder, Perfect Mind. That's the name that got attached to it very early on, because those words appear in title at the end of the text. And exactly, I mean, once again, it's a semantics, it's not a syntax, that's the name. It sounds like a Zen koan. The text itself, the copy we have from the Nag Hammadi material, was written by a scribe on papyrus around or before the year 400. That's all we can say. The text itself probably was written on that parchment prior to 380, because that's about the date when these texts were hidden.
It would have been close to the Athenian Council.
No. Well,
or Crete.
The authorship
primary authorship is different than the scribal date. You see, these texts were translated and transferred, so the copy we have was written by a scribal hand sometime probably in the 300s. Or it could have been earlier. By the script of the hand, this is what papyrologists look at. They look at the script. It's in Sahidic dialect of Coptic. The script is characteristic of anything from the 2nd century on through the 4th century. So it's impossible to say when this piece of paper was scribed. But it was bound in a book that was probably made, you know, so it probably wasn't told. But where does the text start? Well, the text was in Greek. All the Nag Hammadi texts we have are Coptic, which is the language of Egypt. Coptic was the language of Egypt written in Greek text. 300 years before the beginning of our era, Alexander the Great conquered Egypt. And Egypt became a center of Greek culture, particularly in Alexandria, for 300 years. That's why Philo of Alexandria, that's why Wisdom of Solomon, they were writing in Greek. They were Jews writing in Greek in Alexandria. So these Greek texts were translated into the language of Egyptian, which was more frequently used in further to the south in Egypt. And the Sahidic dialect was one dialect they used in the south. And so this text originally was in Greek. And scholars say it was probably composed, and this is, again, it's all probable, because we just simply do not know, probably as early as the 2nd century. Now, but you see, when I say 2nd century, I mean 100 to 200 AD. But then you have to put into perspective the Gospel of John, last book in the canon. Dr. David Miller believes that book was written in 150 AD. Other scholars place it any place between 90 and 120 AD. I don't know why David said 150, but we were talking about this, and he said, I think it's much later. Acts of the Apostles in the Bible. Most scholars would accept that was written around 120 AD, put in that scribal form, you see?
So would have those texts then been part of the whole discussion of what was included?
Right. The thing is, in the year 200, the discussion was just taking place, what is canon?
Right.
It had been going on in various circles. And Gnosticism wasn't a heresy, it was just, as all scholars now point out, it was just one of the component approaches to this mythic language. It was more psychological, it was more, one might say, sophisticated. It was not concretizing text, it was looking at text as an imaginal source for understanding what we were, what it was to be human, what our story was, what the symbols in us were. They were looking at this and reading myth consciously reflected. So, thunder probably dates someplace into this textual history. And it was really not until the late 2nd century, you know, around the year 200, that canon began to be formalized within an Orthodox concept. And why the secret book of John was not part of canon, as opposed to the Gospel of John? Well, look at the story it was telling. It was Sophia's story. These texts I was reading about the Demiurge, how do you work that into Orthodoxy? But in the early formation of Christianity, in that first century, there were people who felt that both stories were complementary. And we'll talk about that next up after lunch.